The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
I'm delighted to be joined by the former First Minister of Scotland and former leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon. She's here to talk about her memoir, Frankly. Nicola, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yeah, great to have a fellow Scot in studio. You know, I was born in Scotland.
Where are you? Whereabouts?
Carnoustie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my parents were there for a couple of years working.
Yeah.
So I've only been back for my sins to Scotland once.
Well, you need to come back again.
Yeah.
And over the years, we'll entice you back.
Back fully into Scottish society. Yeah. I was back to play, can you believe it, shinty hurling hybrid up in Kingussie, up in the Highlands. We had a ball for a few days.
It's a brutal sport.
It is. It is. It's particularly brutal when most of the team have spent half the day in the Tipsy Lair or the Silver Fjord in Kingussie as well.
I thought that was kind of the only way to play it.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Well, listen, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
What's the reaction been like?
It's been great. Very, very positive. I've spoken to lots and lots of big events, lots of people coming along. You know, I think with any politician, you know, the reviews will always be a bit mixed depending on people's political view of you. And there will always be a bit of kind of preconceived, you know, judgment about it. But overall, I've been really happy and I've really enjoyed getting out and about, talking about it and promoting it. And yeah, it's been really good fun.
How much have you enjoyed maybe revealing a side of yourself in the book that people wouldn't have known existed? Because this is a feature in the early chapters is I guess, how much of yourself was maybe, I don't want to say hidden, but maybe unknown even to you when you were trying to kind of forge your own identity.
I mean, I've really enjoyed writing something that was much more personal, much more open than perhaps people would have expected, maybe more open than I expected when I started writing it. I didn't want to write a really traditional memoir, which was, you know, maybe a bit dull and, you know, just a dry account of all the different events that I lived and governed through. So I wanted it to be personal. I wanted it to be quite raw, and I've enjoyed that. You know, people in certainly in Scotland, most people probably think they know everything there is to know about me. But there's lots that people didn't know, or there's things that perhaps people thought they knew that I've maybe been able to give them a bit of a different perspective on.
Do you think, unfairly or otherwise, you had a reputation for being dull?
I think in my earlier days, I did. I think I was...
Was that by choice?
It wasn't really
or
by
design.
Choice. No, it wasn't by choice. I think looking back on it, though, there was a definite sort of subconscious thing at play where I was trying, to, as a young woman in a man's world, I was trying to be accepted. And so that, I think, leads younger women to be a bit more austere in how they present themselves, a bit doer. It's a good Scottish word.
Yeah, we have it. We kind of would say dour.
Dour.
But the same word.
We say dour.
Same word.
And so, yeah, I think it was just my way of trying to fit in with my surroundings. I don't think I was seen as dull later on in my career, partly because I was usually never very far away from some big political issue or controversy. And, you know, in my years as First Minister, there was plenty of how would I describe it, sort of challenging, exciting, unpredictable events that I went through. But yeah, in my younger years, I think I was a bit of a girl who took herself a bit too seriously.
And if you were starting off today, do you think you'd feel under those same pressures as a young woman?
Yeah, I think so. Different in some ways. I wouldn't be as much of a rarity today as I was back then, because there are more women in politics, and that's a good thing. You know, there's not quite a critical mass, but perhaps getting closer to it. But young women today face pressures I didn't face, you know, social media, the abuse that comes via all of the online platforms. So I think I'd still, you know, because I wouldn't have all the hindsight of everything I've learned over the years, I think I'd probably still be, you know, somebody who tried very hard to be taken seriously. If I could go back and give my younger self advice, it would be to lighten up a bit. I think she would probably tell me to F off, if I can be blunt. But, you know, I think it's interesting to look back and think of all the things that if you had your life again, you would do differently. But you do the things that you think are right in the moment. And certainly in my case, learn a lot along the way. And I'm not sure. I mean, there's decisions I would change if I could go back and do it all again. Things I got wrong that I would try to get right. But I don't regret anything about the career path I took. I've had an absolute, brilliant time.
You talk about when you became First Minister and stories then you would have become embroiled in or issues you would have had to deal with. But one of the first things you had to do, and you write about this in the book, was to go to a British-Irish Council meeting, which is, you know, something that the various heads of state are all meant to go to, the English, from Westminster, they rarely attend. But describe to me what maybe your relationship was like then on foot of that with Irish Taoiseach. I think Enda Kenny was at
Enda
that
was
one.
Enda was Taoiseach at the time. And, I had a great relationship with Enda, and I don't think I'm revealing any great confidences here. Enda always turned up late to the British Irish Council. And he would sort of sweep in, and we'd all be perhaps mid-discussion about something or other, and everything would stop when Enda arrived, and he would just regale us all with whatever had been happening in the European Council or whatever. And we all hung on his every word. Enda was great fun and, you know, in my view, a really, you know, serious kind of statesman for Ireland. I've had good relationships with his successors, Leo and Micheál. I worked with both of them over my time as First Minister. I should say I've got great relationships with other Irish politicians. Mary Lou is a pal of mine too. So, yeah, I've always had a great regard for Irish politics. I've got a great interest in Irish politics. Of course, I'm here just now when the presidential election is just getting underway. It's been a part of my job that I really valued and appreciated.
Because you write about Martin McGuinness as well and the relationship he had with Ian Paisley, you talk about as well in the book. How do you reflect on the relationship between Scottish nationalism and Irish nationalism? When it comes to the North,
the relationship between Scotland and Ireland is really strong, and I think it strengthened over my years as First Minister. And that's because we made a concerted effort to look at the areas where we could collaborate more deeply. I think, you know, I wouldn't say there's no relationship at all between, you know, the prospect of Scotland becoming independent and the prospect of Ireland unifying.
Yeah.
But equally, the two things stand on their own terms. They are, pardon the pun, independent of each other. But I think there's a kind of Celtic understanding, solidarity at times. I think Brexit probably also deepened that understanding, certainly of Ireland and people in Ireland. I wouldn't, you know, try to speak for Irish governments, but for the people of Ireland towards the predicament that Brexit put Scotland in. So those relationships are really close and strong, and I'm absolutely certain that will always be the case.
On independence, how now do you reflect on it? Because, you know, you talk about in the book that the reality of the result, disappointing and all as it was not something people would have predicted. No one thought it was going to be that close. Yet, you know, as somebody says, you know, show me the person who comes second, I'll show you a loser.
Exactly.
You know, so that's what it would go down as, an opportunity lost. Is that how you think about it?
Totally. I mean, I given when I look back to the referendum campaign, you know, it's over a decade ago now, and all of the things that, you know, the other side really scaremongered about that would happen to Scotland if we chose independence. I mean, you know, we'd be chucked out of the European Union was almost top of that list. There would be, you know, public spending cuts. You know, all of the things that they scaremongered about actually ended up happening to Scotland because we didn't become independent. So it was a massive lost opportunity. And Scotland's paid a price for not being independent over these years. There's still extraordinary support for independence. You know, it's about 50-50 in the population at large. But if you look at the younger age groups in Scotland, massive support for independence.
And why is that? Why do you think?
I just think younger people have obviously I'm generalising, but I think younger people have a sense of why not? Most countries across the world are independent. It's not a panacea or a guarantor of success, but it puts your future more in your own hands. And most young people understand independence and the desire for independence from a personal perspective, you know, leaving home, going to uni, starting a job, making your own way in the world. And I just think there is this, you know, acceptance that it is a normal state of affairs for a country. And young people are much more internationalist than perhaps older generations might have been, you know, so young people, many, many, many young people in Scotland will come to Dublin and see Ireland thriving as an independent country. So I just think there's an acceptance of the normality of independence.
Does nationalism, though, not fly in the face of internationalism to a degree?
No, I don't think it does. I think there's a perception that it does. Yeah, I yeah, it's a bit ironic, maybe, as the former leader of the Scottish National Party. I think the word nationalist can be a bit of a problem because it conjures up in people's mind, you know, sort of far right.
Yeah, and I guess here in Ireland, we probably have a similar view to it that you do. You describe it as a left of centre. Yeah. Elsewhere in Europe, if you talk about a nationalist party, it's very much, you know, you're kind of a short,
kind of ethnically based,
hop, skip, and jump to fascism.
Quite insular, exactly. But the Scottish independence movement is a self-government project, and it's internationalist. You know, my party is the most pro-immigration party probably in the UK. We were anti-Brexit. We want Scotland to be back in the European Union. So independence is, about being able to shape the country that we want to live in and future generations to live in at home. But it's also about Scotland playing a bigger part in the world. So it's deeply and very, very inherently internationalist.
What, and I know everybody's an expert in retrospect. What mistakes did you make in that referendum?
I think.
What would you do differently?
Remember that we, as you referenced at the start of this discussion, we came from nowhere to almost winning. So by definition, we did lots of things right.
Yeah.
Because nobody would have predicted it was that close, you know, even 18 months out. So it wasn't so much what we did wrong. I think it was more we didn't manage to do enough of the right stuff to convince as many people. I think ultimately what stopped, you know, there were lots of people in Scotland who would never have voted for independence because they believe in the union. And that's a legitimate point of view, and we should respect that. There are many who would never have voted anything other than yes because they believe, you know, deeply that Scotland should be independent. Many in the middle are open to being persuaded, and we persuaded lots of those. The ones that we didn't, it was concern over economics, public finances, what currency we would use, ironically, whether we would get to stay in the European Union. We just didn't manage to convince enough of those open to persuasion people. Now, arguably, if we'd had a bit more time, we might have done that. You can never be sure. So it wasn't so much we got things wrong. It's just we weren't ultimately convincing enough to enough people to get it over the line.
If we fast forward then to one of the other big features of your time in office, which was to do with, you know, gender ID. And again, you know, and this is referenced in the book as well, that the law that was introduced in Scotland was relatively uncontroversial at the time. Totally. There was cross-party support, and actually it existed
already the law here. Yeah.
And what's funny is there's been times in this country where that law has found itself in the spotlight. You know, it's flared up around kind of particular issues.
Yeah.
Maybe so, you know, there's a sporting event and somebody with, you know, who identifies one way or the other then is competing in the other category, or somebody's in a prison. There's kind of a high profile case of someone in Limerick prison. Yet it just kind of seeps away again and people just get back to life as normal. Why do you think it became such a bigger aspect of the culture wars?
It's a good question. It's a
there
really good question.
And not here.
I don't know if I have the whole answer to it. I think it kind of kicked off in Scotland, or didn't kick off because, you know, a few years before when it first started to be progressed, it wasn't controversial.
Mm.
It became controversial. I think it was because it kind of ran into that, you know, global culture war, you know, sort of explosion, really. Some people, you know, I don't, when I kind of try to speculate about some of the motives of some people in this debate, I often get criticised for saying that everybody who disagrees with me on this is guilty of these motives. I don't mean that. Lots of people genuinely are concerned about this. But for some people, it was also a way of getting at me and the SNP. So it just became really, really toxic and still is, frankly. And I think that's a matter of huge regret. You know, when there are particular issues, whether sporting events or prison cases, there was, you know, it was a big furore around a prisoner that really set the whole thing alight in Scotland. And ironically,
they didn't actually spend a lot of time in the female prison.
And ironically, were dealt with in exactly the same way that trans prisoners had been dealt with for years and years and years. So these kind of things were taken and blown up to be really, really big issues. I mean, I still hope we can take a step back from where we are on this issue. I'm a feminist. I've fought for women's rights all my life and always will do. But I don't think that is in conflict with standing up for the rights of trans people, who are, you know, probably the most stigmatised and discriminated against group in society. And I don't think it's beyond us as human beings to come up with a way forward that protects the rights of women and trans people.
It's a kind of a feature of the culture wars, isn't it? That it's those people who are closer to the fringes who dominate the debate. And actually, most people are kind of just trying to muddle through. And maybe when it comes to the trans issue, there's lots of people out there. And, you know, they've never had to deal with it. They don't really get it. But on some level, they want to kind of deal with it in as humane a way as possible.
People, and I think most people
they're squeamish about the prison thing or women's refuges or sport. And at the same time, they want people to be able to flourish.
Exactly. You know, trans people are, less than 0.5% of the population. The threats to women come from abusive men. And, you know, genuinely abusive men must be laughing up their sleeve when they hear all of the debate, you know, focusing on this tiny, tiny minority, an even tinier minority of whom will ever, you know, commit the kind of crimes we're talking about, and when they do should be dealt with. So, yeah, I think most people absolutely just want to do the right thing and let people live the way they want to live. If they're not harming anybody or bothering anybody, then let them live with dignity and respect. And, you know, that's my view. I've never been in politics to kind of stamp on the rights of any minority, and, you know, I never will do, even if that sometimes makes my own life a bit tougher.
Did you ever feel a sense of personal hurt, or that you were being targeted? Say when J.K. Rowling would have worn T-shirts targeting you, for example.
I think there are some people who just seem to fixate on me in this debate. And, you know, I mean, that's their right. And I just sometimes wonder where they get the time or the energy. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have the time or the inclination to do it in reverse. I think everybody's got to be responsible and make their own decisions about how they engage in debates. And, you know, at the time J.K. Rowling did what you're referring to, I was the First Minister. Of course, I should have been under, you know, tough scrutiny, and you know, I had and had to have a thick skin. But, you know, now I'm not First Minister. My view should certainly still be, I still speak out and have a voice. I always will do. My view should be, you know, scrutinised and challenged and all the rest of it. But I think we all just have a responsibility to try to keep debate civil, particularly in the climate we live in today, where, you know, certain rhetoric or ramping up rhetoric can have consequences. And therefore, I think it's all the more important that we try to be responsible about how we go about these things.
Will Nigel Farage be the next British Prime Minister?
You know what? If the UK general election was today, and I fear, he would be. But the UK general election is not today. It's probably 4 years away. And politicians of the left, centre-left, you know, of my political tradition, really have to get our act together and take on Farage and everything he stands for. Farage is basically trying to convince everybody and actually getting away with at the moment, that all of the UK's problems are down to immigrants. And
but Keir Starmer's kind of agreed with them.
Well, you know, look, don't get me started on Keir Starmer. The frustration, I know I'm SNP, he's Labour, so I've, you know, it might sound party political, but it's deep frustration. The whole debate that's kicked off just now in the UK about ID cards. Now, there's a debate for and against ID cards. I've always instinctively been against. But what frustrates me more than anything about that, it's accepting the premise of the Farage argument that the problem is immigration. You know, the UK would be in a worse state than it is right now without immigration. Most immigrants come to work or to study. You know, even the Office of Budget Responsibility says that the UK's debt and deficit would be worse without immigration. Scotland's population would be in decline within about 20 years without immigration. The problems in the UK, as in many countries, stem from the financial crash, austerity politics, inequality, all compounded by Brexit, of which Nigel Farage was one of the biggest architects.
Well, sorry, on that, on Brexit, to cut across, and again, you said, don't get me started, I'm in the same boat, but Keir Starmer seems so allergic to having to talk about Brexit for fear of being asked whether there'll be a second referendum, that he's just decided, you know what, I'm just going to pretend it didn't, that it doesn't exist. And it's surely, what he should be doing is looking at Nigel Farage and pointing at Nigel Farage and saying, sorry, this is what he advocated for.
Look, I mean, exactly. I mean, it's taking on Farage should not mean, you know, ignoring or pretending the real problems people are experiencing don't exist. But if immigration is not the problem, and it's not, then what is? And Brexit is right in there, in the mix, is one of the chief reasons. And you're absolutely right about Keir Starmer. I mean, I worked a bit with Keir Starmer over Brexit when he was part of Jeremy Corbyn's team. you know, Keir Starmer didn't believe in Brexit. Keir Starmer thinks that the UK should be in the EU. But what's the point of having these beliefs and principles if the minute you get into a position of power, you jettison them all? Starmer appears to be allergic to standing up for anything, and he should look at his opinion poll rating and see where that gets him. You know, stand up for something and maybe people will start having a bit more respect. So instead of legitimising Nigel Farage, if you legitimise Farage on immigration, all that you're going to lead people to do is vote for Farage.
Yeah.
Instead, stand up against him, accept the problems people are experiencing, but come up with more credible, a more credible analysis and more credible solutions.
This is really into the realm of the hypothetical, but were he to become Prime Minister, Farage, how does that play out then in terms of what it would mean for Scottish independence?
Well, I think Scotland's going to become independent. I'm not going to put a timescale on it, but certainly well within my lifetime, whatever happens at a UK level. I think if Farage was to become Prime Minister, it would definitely you know, push things in that direction. But what I would say is, for all politicians of my kind of persuasion, left, centre-left, we need to get our act together, grow a backbone, and start behaving in a way right now that makes sure Nigel Farage doesn't become Prime Minister. And that's the thing. If it was today, there was an election in the UK, he would, but it's not today. And that gives us all a bit of time to stop it happening. And, you know, I'm not that confident. I'm confident that my own party will take up that fight in Scotland. I'm not that confident in Starmer. I'm not confident at all in Starmer. But whether he's still the Labour leader by the end of this year, my goodness, let alone...
By the end of the week, Andy Burnham has his eyes on it.
Which is extraordinary. He's only been Prime Minister for about a year, and that's an extraordinary failure on his part to be in this position.
Nicola, congratulations on the book
again. Thank you very much, and thanks. Lovely to talk to you.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.